what is Uncle Danny's Nerdcast? Well, if it's about sci-fi or fantasy, we're going to talk about it here. Star Wars, Star Trek, Lord of the Rings, all the new stuff. We'll dig into a masterpiece like Interstellar. And we will roast the space trash like Rebel Moon. Why Zack Snyder? Why? Most importantly, we'll laugh a lot, have a lot of fun. I have a lot of great guests scheduled. So join us for every episode. This is Uncle Nene's Nerdcast.
All right. Welcome to the show. This is Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I'm Nathan Fletcher, your host, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. My guest today is a pretty special guy. Got an incredible story, incredible background in the sci-fi world. We love the long shot. We love the underdog. My first guest has a kind of his own hero's journey. And we're going to take you through that. It's pretty interesting. I'd like to welcome to the show Michael Stein. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I never looked at my life like that. The hero's journey, like the Save the Cat, John Truby's 22-step story structure, kind of writing for screenplays. But everybody's got their own thumbprint, so I guess yeah.
It's very interesting. Before this, I did some research on you and tried to understand more as much as I could. So hopefully, I got it right. Mostly, we'll see. But before we get into your story, I always like to start with Star Wars or Star Trek. Do you have a preference?
Man, you know, so I love this. You in the pregame, he texted me or emailed me and said, we get to talk about this. I was like, ooh, my story with Star Trek, you know, behind you, you could see a picture right here. That is a picture from Soylent Green. I was 6 years old. That was the first movie my mom ever took me to a movie theater. Everybody, like my wife's, her first movie was E.T. You know, it's very, very, very wholesome and very, very nurturing. Mine was, I was like, why'd you send me to that movie? Why'd you take me to this? Go see that movie? She goes, I don't know. I thought it was a movie about ecology. So it's where people are eating people. It's not.
Yeah. Those 70s movies, they kind of had this kind of a dark, very dark evil empire kind of. Very interesting. Yeah.
So I've always been into personally, like, you know, into, sci-fi, like King Kong was like a personal favorite of mine. Also because of Soylent Green, I don't know, I've been like, had this like fascination with like the day after, like a nuclear war, like end of the world.
Right. Movies, yes.
You know?
Yes. I love watching the world fall apart in a movie. It's great.
Yeah. War of the Worlds. I mean, all that kind of stuff is like, I don't know why it's like, it's, you know, there's a picture of the Baker shot detonation in the South Pacific, which is a famous detonation. We won't get too far on that. Okay, Star Wars versus Star Trek. So my first journey into Star Wars was in a drive-in movie theater in the Van Nuys Drive-In Movie Theater, which is also a picture right behind me. And we went to go see Star Wars. It was 1977, I believe it was. Right? That's when it came out.
77, yes, I believe so.
And I don't want to see that. The De La De Laurentiis King Kong movie in 75 came out before that. And I was like, I just want to see the big gorilla. I want to see that again because I could understand that. I couldn't understand the space. So I didn't like Star Wars in the beginning. I couldn't I had the ADHD. I couldn't comprehend.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving parts to, if you really think about it, in Star Wars for a young kid. Yeah. So, but then Star Trek, I never watched a TV show, but then these movies, the Star Trek movies came out. And they were pretty good, you know? I mean, William Shatner and Spock, those guys are actually really good actors. And by the time they came out with the movies, they were really good and they were written really well. You know, Kobayashi Maru, you are always my be my best friend. And you know, and it's just amazing. And then even with the one with the whales, it's like the Star Trek movies.
Yes.
And then my wife, who is a huge Star Trek or Star Wars fan, she came around and we had kids and we started watching. You know, this is the third wave of Star Wars movies that's come out. And because there was the first wave and then the one in the 90s, everybody kind of gave a shit about, you know, what the Jar Jar Binks and all that bullshit. And then they had the new, I think the third wave, I think I really did it justice. I said, I'm going to go back into watching all the Star Wars and give it a shot. And I will tell you, also getting involved, heavily involved in personal development, you know, Empire Strikes Back is like the first step towards personal development. Tony Robbins plays a lot of scenes from Empire Strikes Back
In a seminar. Interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know that about Empire, but it's my favorite from the first trilogy as well. Yeah.
Yoda, you know, is like, that is when you fail. And there's so many lessons to be learned. You want to learn about life, watch Empire Strikes Back. Well, you got to watch all the Star Wars and look at the subtext. And it's also written really well. So I started to go back in there and I fell in love. So Star Trek was really my first love out of the two.
The movie. Interesting. Same thing for me. The movies is where I never saw the original series with William Shatner, right? It was the movies got me. And then, of course, I fell in love with Spock. Spock was my favorite character, you know. And then I started watching the TNG series, Next Generation, and then fell in love with that. But I like both. I like Star Wars and Star Trek. I think I feel like the Star Trek universe is what we wish it could be, in the Star Wars universe is what it really is. You know what I mean? Like, Star Trek's very utopian. There's no money, you know, we're just working together as the Federation. It's wonderful. And Star Wars is, there's an evil empire and there's the rebellion. And, you know, so I kind of, that's my take on it.
You got Khan, you know, Khan.
Yes.
He's the evil. He's the, you know. And if you get into Shatner and like his whole like vibe in the late 60s, early 70s, he had this whole cool, like, he got into poetry and that whole vibe. Have you seen those videos?
Oh, yeah.
And it's so cool, you know, and he's that guy, you know.
The spoken word.
Have you seen an interview with Mike Tyson, you know, your Shatner?
Incredible. There's a show or a documentary called, I think it's called The Chair, and he interviews all the different people who have been a captain in the Star Trek universe. So, and I didn't realize he was such a good interviewer. He's really incredible. Yeah. Amazing. All right. So we dived in on there.
We can nerd out on that for a while.
We can do that for a while.
We'll really scare everybody, I guess.
I'd like to get into, you know, your story as being a, you know, 19-year-old stand-up comic in Los Angeles. And then, you know, you, of course, early in life, you're on neurodivergent ADHD as well. And so I totally identify with that. Starting off from being a kid and then becoming a stand-up comic in 19, and talk a little bit about just like what that life was like and how that, because I think unfathomable to a lot of people that a kid that, you know, could stutter and has ADHD and things like that, and then 19, a stand-up comic, like that to me is incredible. So talk to me a little bit about how that happened.
Right. So I do a podcast called Long Shot Leaders, and I consider myself a long shot. And, you know, basically I was an unplanned child. My mom constantly, you know, used to remind people, hey, he wasn't planned. I ran up and down the stairs. I drank, I smoked, but he survived. I'm like, Mom, they just want to know if you want ranch or blue cheese. You don't need to tell everybody the story. Yeah. Plastic or paper, you know, everybody should tell the story. You know, so my grandmother, you know, since my dad made a lot of money and he lost all the money, and I was the youngest in a large family. So I had to sleep with my grandmother in the same room off and on until I was 9 years old. And my bedtime story was like, you know, how she escaped the Russian concentration camps. So you like me lie. My dad was a New York homeless street kid. You know, it became, you know, so you're lucky to, like, he didn't finish the eighth grade, but he started business when he was 13, you know, so you grow up with these things. I'm like, I consider myself a long shot. I was born premature, ADHD. They didn't know what it was. I had a stutter. I had a focusing issue. It wasn't quite dyslexia. It was some kind of weird. I had to go to special doctors for that. I was put in a special needs school for knowledge school at UCLA. When I was like 8, 9 years old, I was like, why am I here? Why is this kid, Down syndrome kid with named Frisbee trying to, like, you know, wail at me?
Right.
You know, I was like, you know, it was just weird. You know, so I was like, the only thing success I had was making people laugh, you know, self-deprecation.
Okay. Yeah. So okay.
I was good at that. So I took pride in that. My family was a bunch of fast talkers, and they talk so fast. And there's a large family, like, you know, typical Jewish crazy, you know, family, and everybody talking over each other. And, you know, they're all comedians. And I couldn't, my brain was fast. And that's the thing that people don't know about ADHD. The brain works fast, and my mouth couldn't catch up with my brain. There's so many things you're thinking about. So I would stumble over words, and I didn't really, and also I had a lot of health issues, and I didn't really have any success other than that, making people laugh. Other than when I saw the movie Rocky, like most American kids, I said, hey, here's a guy like me. He's not smart. They say he's not smart.
Yeah.
He keeps on trying. He's funny, because he was very, Rocky was funny.
You
always try to tell jokes. You know, and I said, the only difference between this guy and myself is he's physically fit. So I said every day since then, so I was like 11 or 12 years old, I said, I'm going to be physically fit. Started exercising every day. And by the time I was 16, I became a physical fitness trainer. I was like, oh, time plus effort, just like, you know, it's my second success. Okay. So then, you know, I had a high school tutor, you know, I wasn't a good student. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be like the calculator kid, like my dad. He sold all these calculators and, you know, and he became a millionaire. And I want to start my own business. And she goes, well, why don't you work with your hands? Because not everybody's meant to do what they want to do. So I said, screw you. My dad never finished eighth grade, became a multimillionaire. Granted, he's living in a van outside of the house that he bought in Encino, but he was successful.
Yeah.
So started a business, failed, you know, after a couple of days. So made like two sales within an hour and then never make sales out of that. It was summertime and I, you know, just graduated like 2 days before. So I said, you know, let me figure this out. Went to City College, took acting, took psychology, took business. And then I wanted to do stand up, but I was 19, just turned 19. And I said, I'm going to do stand up. And I brought a lot of people there and I did well, you know, for my first time. But I said, I can't make any money doing stand up. I know comedians don't make money for a long time. But I brought a lot of people here and nightclubs were really big in the late 80s. So I, you know, dance clubs. And I said, you know, I could promote nightclubs. And within 6 months, I started a dance club called Off the Wall. In six months after that, became the number one nightclub promoter in Los Angeles, in my age bracket.
Wow.
And
that's great.
And that helped me, you know, I started doing more stand-up. It helped me meet people like my first acting role was playing Dirt Diggler, and the Dirt Diggler story was a short film to
Paul Thomas Anderson. It's funny you mentioned that.
Yeah.
So I want to show the folks, I think you're 21 when you did this, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to show a clip.
No one's ever done this. This is cool.
This is you, right?
Yeah, look at there, long hair. That's Bob Ridgely. Who was in the movie Philadelphia, lots of movies, and he passed away with cancer.
Oh, he's very recognizable. I knew I recognized him. I didn't know what from. But that's you. So you were fit. Yeah, you definitely were working out.
Yeah. That was I was a fit stand-up comedian, inspiring actor, nightclub promoter. I was very, had a lot of energy. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, so I had those, look at the look.
Oh, wow. So how did that come about? Paul Thomas Anderson, of course, you know, incredible director, would go on to do Boogie Nights, in which you have a cameo on, and then he did There Will Be Blood and all these other amazing movies. How did you come across him doing this short film, which was, I'm guessing, shot on video, it looks like, or was that, that was probably video. So how'd that all happen?
He was dating Elizabeth, or Jody Gruber. I was dating Elizabeth Gruber. He needed a ride home one night. And I walk out of the Gruber's house and he's like, because he crashed his Cherokee. He got a Cherokee when he was 16 and he crashed it. And his dad's like, I'm not buying you a new car. So he's like, can you drive me to my house? I said, sure. And I had him rolling on the way there and we were making him laugh. And he's a funny guy too. Yeah. He's got a great sense of humor. A lot of people don't know that. And we just clicked. And then like a couple of days later, he's like, I got an idea. I want to do a short film about the rise and fall of a porno star, kind of like, you know, a documentary style, like, you know, Spinal Tap. And I said, I'm in, you know, let's just do it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, of course.
And we just became really good friends and we shot that. And then years later, you know, he of course, you know, he was destined to become a filmmaker.
I think 9 years, right, before Boogie Nights actually got made. Years. It was a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I do have the clip of you in Boogie Nights, which I think I had no idea this was you until I did my research. And I was like, oh my God, that's a hilarious scene. So let me just show it.
What's the price for the 420?
I have this very unit in my home.
Really?
Yes, I do. You're still a little uncertain, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know what you need? You need a test drive. So let me just pop in this 8-track. And you just give a list and tell me what you think, okay?
You hear the bass, right? Thank you for your time.
I think that's normally you don't think of Paul Thomas Anderson as having a sense of humor, but I think it came across in that scene. That scene, it definitely does.
If I was going to reveal a secret about Paul, he's got a great sense of humor. He's actually very funny.
Oh, that's great. So after Boogie Nights and all of that, I think actually, way before Boogie Nights, you did. Oh, no, it was a little after Boogie Nights was Rituals and Resolutions. I have a little bit of that to show.
Wow.
Let's take a look at that, then have you kind of talk about what we see.
Sure.
I need to borrow some money.
How much do you owe?
$17,000. I owe $17,000. It's past due and I'm flat broke.
You're asking me for $17,000?
I'll do anything.
Got a couple of problems I have to figure out, that's all.
Like what? What kind of problems?
It's a little difficult to talk about it.
Hey, Will, you know you can talk to us.
I'm getting married in a month, and...
Yeah, well, there's your problem right there.
But I keep getting these thoughts.
I love that line. Well, there's your problem right there. So tell me about this. I hadn't heard about it. It seems really interesting from what I could find online.
Yeah, that's a trailer to Rituals Resolution. It's a half-hour short film, dramatic, dark comedy. And it's about 320 stories about people that have let their negative rituals rule their life. They all decide to try to kick their habits and become better people within, you know, one night, but they all compromise themselves before the night is done. And there's a dark twist at the end. And that did well. That was my first live action short film. It got bought by HBO, won Oberhausen and Palm Springs International and many other film festivals. And that was my calling card to become a filmmaker and an actor.
That's great. That's great. And so, you know, that was obviously well received. You know, I think, you know, most of my experience in production has been on the unscripted side, like reality TV, docufollow. I've done a lot of that kind of stuff, sports comedy specials, things like that. Never really got to work in the scripted space. So you started off wanting to be a filmmaker, wanting to be a producer, writer, director.
I started off wanting to be an actor because I saw Jackie Gleason and Smokey and the Bandit. And I said, whatever Jackie Gleason's doing is the sheriff in Smokey and the Bandit. When I was a kid, I'm like, I want to do that. And then,
yeah.
And then I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And then, of course, you know, so as an actor, stand-up comedian, I just started doing filmmaking. I was inspired by Paul because he was so successful and why he was doing it. I said, well, I saw him, you know, through those years after the Dirt Diggler story. I was like, this can be done, you know. And I, you know, and also dating Elizabeth Goober and Peter Goober, you know, understanding how movies worked, you know, because I never knew the industry after started dating her and seeing this whole world of like Batman, Rain Man, and all that. So I said, this is doable, you know, just time plus effort again, like working out or anything else. Of course, much more difficult gear because it's the most competitive industry on the planet, but. Yeah. I wanted to be a filmmaker because I said that'll be a great way to become, you know, just put myself in my own movies.
So there is something in the media business that you know very well called development hell. It happens, right? We go down the road trying to develop a show and, you know, it never can come together or, you know, things like happen like that. You eventually find a way to work through all that in an independent feature film with Love Hollywood Style. And I'd like you to just talk a little bit about that, how that came about and your journey in that.
Right. Good job. So you really did your homework. You're good. So this is his first episode, guy. He is killing it. Okay. So the Love Hollywood Style, I got close to a movie deal with Rituals and Resolutions. I had a deal with Trimark Pictures and Lionsgate. Robin Shore was the VP, and she's like, we're going to make your movie Underground Games, which is a gambling movie, underground gambling. It was a true story. When I was a nightclub owner, I started doing underground gambling casinos in Los Angeles. So a screenplay about it. And I got close to making a movie with them, but no deal. You know, she left the company and it just fell through. And I've had meetings with Joel Silver's office and so many people. I can name it. You know, it was a tour de France.
Right.
After a year and a half, I said, I can't do this. I'm too much of an entrepreneur. I'm too much of a hyper self-starting person, you know? So I decided I'm going to start a business again because I was a nightclub promoter and then I just left it all. You know, I was making good money as a nightclub promoter. I was like a mini celebrity, you know? And then I was a production assistant because I wanted to learn production. That was my film. So I did that for 5 years. That was my film education. That's the way Paul did it. Paul dropped out of NYU because he'd be, you know, so,
yep.
so. So I said, screw it. I got to become an entrepreneur. And I said, I'm just going to sell. Remember that tool business I did for like 2 weeks when I graduated high school? It failed. But I said, I'm going to do something like that. But the internet is like, it was 1999. I started, you know, looking ideas. And I said, I'm just going to do tarps because my dad's old business partner, my dad had a tool business in the late 60s. And before he started selling these calculators, it was tool business. And my dad left that tool business. And then he came back to it in 75 after that calculator business kind of, fell under after he made all his money. And then that person, his old business partner, is a guy named Alan Smith, who started Harbor Freight. So I've seen this rich dad, poor dad thing. And I said, so my dad would like sell all these, you know, this catalog of stuff. And I was going through the catalog of Harbor Freight and my dad was selling. And I said, you're going to sell these tarps. You know, tarps are just a simple item that a lot of people use for many different things. And I was broken in debt. I didn't have any money. I just filed bankruptcy because couldn't pay back for the money from Rituals and Resolutions. And I didn't, but I built a Yahoo store and I was as a production assistant, I started working after an 18-hour day setting up this website. It started to make money. I didn't have to become a production assistant before. And I was saying, this is my film business. This is going to get me the money to do a feature film. And I didn't do Underground Games because I said, screw you guys. I'm going to do a movie that nobody would ever want to make. It's going to be a self-indulgent comedy that I would make when I was a kid because I love Kentucky Fried movie and I love Woody Allen's Bananas and all that. And I loved American Beauty also at the time, that came out.
Okay.
So I wanted to make this dramatic, like over the top comedy. And that's what Love Hollywood style was. Within 6 months, I made enough money to make a movie we casted Faye Dunaway, Andy Dick, Coolio, Stephen Tobolowsky, Robert Picardo, who was in Star Trek.
Yes. Trek Voyager. Yes.
Yeah. And on all these other great actors. And I was able to write, direct, produce, and act and this film about four intertwining stories about love and dysfunctional love in Hollywood, which is an oxymoronic. And it did well. It didn't make all its money back, but it did well, and it got bought by some places. But since then, I've taken care of the business that I've had, and that's what I am. I'm now an entrepreneur.
Let's take a look. I want to my rule typically is if you can watch 30 seconds of something and it makes you want to see more, it's pretty good. And when I saw this, I was like, oh, I'd love to see the whole thing. This seems interesting. So let me show you.
Now, Walter will escort you back.
Wait a second. What was that last part? What do you mean I won't be able to remember anything?
We can't have you back on Earth knowing what you know now.
Well, but a lot of people are going to know. Carol Ann knows.
Now, as far as Earth is concerned, thanks to you, it will be as if this whole thing never happened.
Will Carol Ann remember me?
I'm afraid not, Milton.
But that's not fair. I mean, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life. And now no one, including myself, will ever know that it even happened.
So that was great. So tell me, what was it like working with, of course, the legendary Faye Dunaway?
Oh, God. I was like telling myself, I said, Mike, I said, win, lose, or draw. This is like, we had a chance. She did have to get paid. But I said, I knew how to be an independent filmmaker at that point because I did a documentary, before I did Rituals Resolution. I went around the country for 4 months. I knew there's some tricks. And one of the tricks are, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to be able to get some good talent, you send out the script, and it did help that I did Rituals and Resolution, and I was coming off like a really good thing. But, I sent out the script, and I said, well, she's busy. And I said, well, look, I'll tell you what. Let's dial back with them. I had my B cast and my A cast. The B cast was like, if she doesn't come through, I'll use this person. The A cast is, hey, look, if Faye's available, send over that script again one more time. We knew her lawyer. And I said, look, if she's not doing anything, let's do it. Let's have her play God, and I knew that would appeal to her. I said, I said, it's going to be done very tastefully. It's going to be done with a lot of drama, but it's comedy, there's a lot of subtext and all this, cause I was I'm a heady person. And she liked that cause I write for actors, So she said, fine, 10 grand in a bag, 4 hours. I said, we're going to shoot everything around you at a studio. We're going to have a car pick you up, make everything easy and simple for everybody. See, every objection was already kind of done out, you know, and solved. And that's how we got Faye Dunaway. And what it was like to work with her, I said, Mike, I used all my, because I've studied, you know, acting to this point, you know, since Dirk Diggler's story, I started acting, you know, studying acting every day, you know, with Eric Morris and so many acting teachers. And I used, I was really in tuned. So I got to play tennis, so to speak, as an actor, you know, hitting back yeah. and forth
yep. with yeah.
multiple Academy Award winning, you know, heavyweight. And it was amazing. It was so, it's like butter, you know, it's like a hot nice butter, because you're playing back and forth with each other and then you're in the zone and she's so good and so charismatic. It was wonderful. And we're on this set. That's a white site.
And you weren't intimidated at all by her, or were you, you know, just, it was fine.
No, oddly enough, because at that point, you know, through nightclubs, the acting, and Paul was doing so well as a filmmaker, you know, and being around Peter Guber and John Peters and all these people,
yeah.
they're just people. And I used to have that notion, you know, early on, but I've been through the arena. I said, you know, I said, I deserve, you know, this, I've done this. And also I knew not to go in there like that. You have to count your
functions.
And Eric Morris says, do a Superman exercise. Eric Morris, great acting teacher. He's in that film as well, plays a psychologist, which is perfect. And I, you know, so you built yourself up to a crescendo of confidence to where you can rise to the occasion, because I knew that was my responsibility, because I didn't want her to feel, you know, like she was wasting her time. And I really yeah. wanted her respect. You know, she actually started calling me Liam, which is her son's name. And she's like, oh, shit, yeah. But, you know, that's the way I went into it. And I had these amazing angels behind me. They play angels, Robert Picardo, Ed yep. Lauder, and Larry Drake, who are these amazing character actors. And I got to act with them before she came on, before the first half of that day. So I was like, and we were playing tennis great as well, because those guys are like so good. So we were,
yeah.
it was.
It's so funny you say that, because that is one of the clips that I yeah. picked, because, you know, for the Star Trek people out there, they got to see the Doctor. But it's a great scene. So let's
see. I mean, why don't you zap down one of those Green Beret recon type angels or something?
It doesn't work that way.
Look, you got the wrong person, okay? I'm not a violent guy. Last time I got in a fight was in the first grade, and I lost. To Linda Pushkin. Somebody made a mistake. It's okay. It's not your fault. Somebody just messed up with the paperwork. That's all.
This is not a mistake. Didn't you say you wished you could do more with your life? Well,
I said I wanted to do more with my life, not go 12 rounds with the Antichrist.
All of civilization depends on you. Now you must take action.
Those are all great actors that you're surrounded by. Those guys, you know, I've always, like, there's these, you know, people that you've seen in so many movies and TV shows, and you're like, I'm not sure what their name is, but every time they're in something, it instantly becomes better, you know, and those guys definitely qualify for that. I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about you had a role in organizing the promotional event for Batman, you know, of course, I was born in 78. So when Batman came out, I was like 10 or 11, you know, and it changed my life. You know, I'd already been reading the comic books, because I was a comic book nerd. And so then when Batman came out, it was incredible. I, you know, fell in love with it. I think it's pretty cool. You had some role in that, but tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay. I'll give you a really fun story real quick. It was such a great moment for me. I was 21. And I was up in Aspen with the Goobers, and I felt like a fish out of water, because, you know, I'm like, oh my God, this is insane. These guys, I mean, you're talking about a lifestyle. Took private Learjet there. We actually took, we had to stop and rifle and take Wagoneer limousines. And then Danny Sullivan put us on snowmobile rides waiting for us at Peter Goober's ranch. I'm playing pool with Vanna White, Barry Levinson, who won the Academy.
Wow.
I just went for Rain Man. I was like, this is insane. You know, and I felt like,
yes.
even though I grew up in Encino, I was in a poor family that grew up
right.
in Encino. But then the Goobers, and I didn't feel self-worth. So then I see my friend, an acquaintance of mine, Chris Peters. He's wearing a black leather jacket. I'm wearing a black aviator jacket. I'm like, I kind of feel like this guy's kind of like me. And he goes, what have you been up to? Because we're meeting at this Mezzaluna restaurant with the two families, Goobers and Peters. He goes, I said, I've been promoting nightclubs. I said, what have you been doing? He goes, I kind of want to get into promoting nightclubs. And I was like, ooh, ding, ding, ding. I find my self-worth. We sit down, we start having a conversation, and we get on the subject of the Batman party. I said, why don't we do a Batman party. We'll rent out the Park Plaza Hotel, which was the holy grail of locations in like Lesson Zero, which was a location that Robert Downey Jr. is trying to get. This is the holy grail of venues in L.A., 4,000 people venue. And I said, we'll get that hotel. We'll get shirts and all your promotionals. We'll promote it for 6 months. It'll be the biggest movie nightclub event ever. And John's, I'm a hustler. All right. I'm a hustler. And John.
Right. Yeah.
Peter Guber's, you know, he's a lawyer. He's taken the bar, you know, before he was, you know, president at 27 for Columbia. He was a lawyer. He was a law degree.
Okay.
John Peters he's a street guy and he takes pride in that.
Okay.
So he hears me talking this and I got like 17 people at the table and he's like, I like this kid. He's like, what do you need? You know, cause I'm flowing. Right. And he goes, what do you need? Well, if we can get your Rolodex, you know, and get all those people invited and send out email, he goes, so you tell me, we get the Rolodex, you can get 4,000 people. I'm like, we could charge 20 a head. It'll promote your movie and all that. And 2 weeks later, we're walking on the Warner Brothers lot and he's walking us around and I'm meeting with the head of advertising at Warner Brothers, Rob Friedman. And
you're 21 when this is happening?
Yeah.
Oh my God. You know, wow.
Keep in mind, I was in my age bracket, I was a top nightclub promoter in LA. So
yeah,
it was easy to get a lot of favors in the LA club scene. And then I got that venue. I got, you know, Matt Dyke of Delicious Vinyl, who started that company. He was my DJ. But we had so many other things. I could just go on and on. But it was the first time people saw the logo. So it said, you know, there's Guber Peters Productions, right? So I said, Stein Peters Productions presents logo, the party. And that's exactly what they did for the premiere that was after our promotional party. You know,
okay.
Because we were promoting the 6 months in advance. So I said, Rob Friedman saw my invite and he kind of gave it, you know, the same thing. And it was amazing. It was a great time promoting it, being around that whole atmosphere. And that was a wonderful experience. And I always look at the Batman, you know, like that.
That's great. Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I was about the same age, 20, 21, somewhere in there, you know, I started working in production when I was 16. So when I was 21, somewhere in there, I was already being put in like to manage different things and leadership roles. And one of the things that I did was we had a concert series. And so I'm running a concert, down in South Texas on the island. And, you know, these are huge. It's a Spanish concert, but, you know, 10, 15,000 people showing up and I'm managing the event. I'm in charge of the event, right? I'm paying all the artists. Hiring security, you know, I've got a whole crew that's doing it.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that it was so much pressure at being 20 years old, 21, and it was, you know, it's a pressure cooker. I mean, and things did not go smoothly. If you know anything about the promoting business, the concert business, anything like that, things don't go smoothly with artists, with security, with police, with everything. And so I can definitely identify with that. But it's a baptism by fire. I think it hardens you. You learn things, and then you take those skills elsewhere. So my hat's off to you for that. The other thing I wanted to talk about was your Long Shot Leaders podcast. I want to play a little clip and then you can tell us a little bit about what you're doing with this. Let's take a look.
You know, well, how are you going to make sure that like every book is going to really have the quality? It's going to be in the stores. Everything's going to be like, how do you really get the most out of that book for that person that has that book? Promotion, advertising, everything.
Yeah. Well, a big chunk of that too is Michael is actually at our writer's retreat. So he's there for the whole month. I pop in for about a week. So he guides everyone through the process. I mean, he is the number one book strategist in the world. So nobody knows books and publishing more than Michael Drew. So he's a legend in the space. So he guides everyone through it. He has a whole process and system. But then we also have editors and graphic artists to make sure it all gets done as well.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what this podcast series is and what you're doing there.
That was a really good friend of mine, David Michaels, who's a New York Times bestseller author himself. Long Shot Leaders is like, you know, I wanted to do a podcast years ago, you know, and it's been about 3.5, 4 years now, 3 years. And I said, if I ever was going to do one, what it'd have to be something that is me, you know, and like, I can't do anything, you know, as when you're a stand-up comedian, you know, in heart, you're like, you have to talk about what's you. You can't be anything else other than is you.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I consider myself a long shot, so I need to, and I feel like I've seen ups and downs. I can go through a litany of like so many ups and downs, but I've navigated out of that and I find sustained success, you know, eventually to where I haven't gone down again. And I said, that would be an interesting podcast to talk about people that, you know, have had been long shots that have started from, it doesn't have to be monetary, it could be any kind of adversity, have started from a low point and navigated out of that and have found sustained long-term success, whether it's financial, physical, mental, metaphysical, relationships, whatever. And that's what Long Shot Leaders is all about.
That's great. That's great. It's, I think that's true. I know for myself, I started this podcast because my, both of my daughters had grown up, moved out of the house, and I have all this spare time. My wife and I have our dogs, but other than that, we have spare time, and I'm a consultant and in my professional business. And so I have some free time. And I said, well, if I wanted to do something, what would I do? And it would be, you know, it'd be a podcast about science fiction, fantasy, movie making, you know, TV shows, all of that, because that's what I love. And so, you know, it's funny. I think when you do something you love, it's very easy, and usually it works out better, you know. So that's great. So before we wrap it up, I thought a few questions I think that our listeners would really enjoy. I guess as a storyteller, are there particular science fiction or fantasy creators that jump out to you that, like, I love their storytelling approach? You know, anything that kind of jumps out?
Well, you got to go with the granddaddy of them all. You got to go with Spielberg. I mean, you know, he just knows how to, whether it's the vibration of the water or, yes, just, he knows his Hitchcockian type of tactics. And he has what I would call at this point, when it comes to science fiction, unconscious competence, to where he has such a level of mastery with when it comes to storytelling that when you see his films, it is so insanely like crafted in a sense that he knows the psychology of what a good sci-fi movie can do. So,
yes,
you know, as my wife walks by in the room, she's E.T. You know, I was going to say that my wife watched her walk by and I'm talking about it. You know, we're a big Spielberg, fan, and look what he does in that. You know, that's Jordan fading back 3 points, nothing but net. Yes. Don't make it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's you know, it's like I never went to film school, but watching all of those movies over and over again was my film school. You know, I just learned so much from watching those. Spielberg is one of the masters. I mean, Jaws. I mean, there's just, you can go on and on. I agree completely. Let's see. I guess what advice for aspiring filmmakers or content creators? You know, I think you have a lot of experience. You've been through the grinder. You know what it's like. What advice would you give them if you had, you know, one piece of advice overall? What would that be?
Well, you know, I navigated out of filmmaking and acting to become a full-time entrepreneur. So I would, you know, say if I would go back to do something, to have a long sustained career in acting and filmmaking or entertainment, first of all, start as soon as possible. You know, back to Paul, you know, he was 6 years old in first grade and he wrote his, one of his assignments says, what do you want to do when you grow up? He says, I want to be a writer, director, special effects man, producer. I can do everything. I will do everything. Listen to that. Listen to that. You know, tell yourself you can do it, you know, and also believe in yourself and start as early as possible. Anybody, as far as starting early, you know, I've talked to so many people, you know, on the podcast now. And when they have that early data set of knowledge, it's irreplaceable. So you're never too young. Start immediately doing something, whether you're going, whether in nursery school, you know, whatever. Start, say, well, I want to do that. Let me have fun understanding that and getting into that, or whatever grade you're at. And you're never too late. It depends on what you want to do. So that's the first step. The second step is get scope of what, you know, who you are and as a person, and always believe in yourself. You know, that would be the second step. Third step is I tell this to everybody, whether it's out, you know, film industry or outside of that, whether it's, you know, just in life, get into personal development. People, you know, they don't teach it in schools, and it's really ridiculous, because if you want to be able to be a better, you know, person or a storyteller, you're going to need to know why people do what they do and why you're doing what you do. That took me a while, because I was a crazy person that was just like, you know, if I knew that earlier. And that's why when I was 20, I got heavily involved in personal development, because there were so many question marks in my head. and craziness. Yeah. Although that would be the first steps, I would say to you, take those, don't take those lightly, take those seriously and quadruple down on taking action on those things.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well said. Let's see. I think, you know, one more question I think that it would be good is if you could direct or produce or write one science fiction or fantasy project in any universe that you know of, right? Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, Harry Potter. Is there any universe that you're like, boy, I would love to do a project in that universe?
You know, I guess I can answer that in a weird way. First of all, I don't know, nuclear war film, is that science fiction?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I consider it's apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic, but still yeah. It can be a part of sci-fi.
It's weird coming from a comedian, but I have always had, maybe because of Soylent Green, and I'm an 80s kid, you know, and The Day After was such a big, you know, thing for me, which people that don't know, that was a miniseries that came out in 1983 that was, you know, about nuclear war.
Hugely impactful. I mean, everyone that saw it, it almost wouldn't air in today's world because of the ending. It dramatic, too traumatic to a lot of people.
Right. And I think I have this terrible dystopian or whatever, you know, outlook on, I'm a very romantic, you know, optimistic person. At the same time, I'm very pessimistic, you know, the yin and the yang. So I will say, you know, this world is such a beautiful place. And maybe that's why I upset, you know, I will think, you know, not obsessed, but like I used to. And if I was going to make a movie, it'd be about showing the possibility of the darkness of a man's inhumanity to man, which will be, you know, once, you know, technology catches up with, you know, man's, you know, darkness, I think we're in for, you know, some trouble. Now, I don't know when that's going to be, but I do know that, you know, history repeats itself and not to be so dark, but I think part of me would make that movie, you know, like something that's never been made before, where the beginning, middle and end of long before and, you know, after, you know, be, you know, documented and really try to, you know, have a nitty gritty, you know, no holds bar, you know, situation that is extremely realistic and possible.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great series called Silo. It's on Apple TV, and it is very, I think, post-apocalyptic, very close to what could happen. You know, basically these people live underground in giant silos, right? And they don't know how the world ended outside, but supposedly the world outside is toxic and they have to live underground to survive. And it's how does society change in that environment? And it's phenomenal. But I agree with you completely. Those are great storytelling because, you know, humanity and our weaknesses and strengths get amplified, you know, when tragedy strikes. And so it's great for storytelling. So I understand that.
I do want to be able to say that I'm so excited for, I still get excited about the Superman movie coming out July 11th.
Yes.
And I'm not promoting that. I just say I'm so excited about that. I think that there's a lot of good inspirational, you know, people really bag on these like Marvel movies and DC movies, but you know what? You know, they're getting people to go to the movie theater.
Absolutely.
And there's all different types of art. You know, I'm a huge Scorsese, Tarantino. I love Paul's movies, you know, and I think those are great, but then like, sometimes you want a burger, you know, you don't always want caviar. So, and I'm excited to see a lot of those movies that are inspirational, you know, and there are, you know, some subtext in those and lessons to learn.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, I agree completely. So, you know, Robert Downey Jr. being cast as Iron Man is one of the most brilliant decisions ever made. He is perfect for that. And, you know, in the comic books, you know, Tony Stark was an alcoholic and he has this path, you know, it's like there's this parallel between him and Robert Downey Jr. in real life. And it was just, he's perfectly captured that. And so, yeah, I think that some of those movies are great filmmaking and some are not so great, but A lot of them are really good. The Avengers, the Russo brothers, what they did with Endgame, Infinity Stones, it was brilliant. I loved it. So, well, we'll wrap it up. Time is coming to an end here. But, man, I had a great time. Thank you for coming on the show. And, yes, this was my first recording ever podcast. So it was great to have you on. And, you know, please let me know if there's anything, you know, anything you want to tell our audience about before we go.
Nathan Fletcher, great job. This is really great. Now, just you want to check out me, you can go to michaelsteinmedia.com. You can see, you know, we have three podcasts out right now: Longshot Leaders, Bolator, which is my outdoor products brand, and the DIY Not podcast, which is, you know, DIY, you know, projects and stuff, and Longshot Leaders and all that. And you can go there and check that out. You can see my bio and all that. And yeah, that's it. And then again, I think this is you did a great job on this first episode. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Well, thanks. We will see you again, I'm sure.
Thanks.
All right.